This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Futuro.
I'm still like getting used to seeing people in person without a mask, especially inside.
I know.
That I don't know if you feel this way, but like I always feel like I'm doing something like wrong.
I know.
And I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna get caught, but it's fine.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, opens up about the past year in a personal one-on-one interview. The last in-person interview I did for Latino USA was in March of 2020. We all know what happened next. A global shutdown because of a pandemic.
Fast-breaking developments in the coronavirus emergency in the U.S. and around the world.
Followed by a massive economic downturn.
Many working class Americans don't have the option to work from home. And the jobs they were counting on in a bar or restaurant or a retail store may not be coming back as soon as they'd hoped.
An uprising of national Black Lives Matter protests.
We out here because we need to be heard. Our voices need to be heard. Our faces need to be heard. The people need to hear us. If we stay quiet, nothing happens.
A presidential election, an attempted coup, and a new but unsurprising border crisis.
The administration wants to get kids out, but they're dealing with so many of them right now, they're just frankly overwhelmed.
Considering all of that, it seemed just right that my first in-person interview after 15 months would be with a leader of the United States' political future, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. AOC represents parts of Queens and the Bronx, which are home to large working-class Black and immigrant communities in New York City. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, Ocasio-Cortez's priority has been helping people on the ground, literally. Last spring, as the coronavirus raged through New York City, AOC would often go out herself to provide food and supplies to her neighbors and constituents.
This morning, we are heading into the most heavily impacted neighborhood in the country, in our backyard, Corona, Queens.
She's also responded to the many other defining events of the past year. Amid Black Lives Matter protests last summer, AOC joined calls to defund police forces across the country.
You have an entire city budget, and half of that budget goes to policing. We have a problem.
Mass unemployment resulted in economic insecurity for millions of Americans. Ocasio-Cortez led the charge for strong stimulus packages for individuals and small businesses, holding both the Trump and Biden administrations accountable.
We passed unprecedented huge amounts of money to relief. And who did it go to? Who did it go to?
Then the election happened. And soon after, there was the Capitol riot on January 6th. In the weeks following that attempted coup, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez opened up about her experience on her own terms during an Instagram Live.
These folks who tell us to move on, that it's not a big deal, that we should forget what's happened, or even telling us to apologize, these are the same tactics of abusers.
The Congresswoman and I, both fully vaccinated by now, met at her campaign office in her district in the Northern Bronx. And from the moment our mics were on, we got right into it. She spoke about the pandemic and the Capitol riot, as well as immigration, American history and her personal thoughts about being a young, influential Latina navigating the American political system. I'm like, am I actually sitting here? We're 5 feet apart.
Yeah.
So not six.
Yeah.
We're both fully vaccinated. So we took off our masks. Mm-hmm. By the way, I was sick with COVID at the beginning.
Oh my God.
And so then when I would see you getting on the train, mm-hmm. I was like, damn, AOC, because you put your body out there.
Yeah.
You got the vans, you got the groceries, you were knocking on people's doors. Again, I was like, oh my God, you haven't stopped.
Yeah, no. I mean, the thing is too, is that because our city, but also my district was the hardest hit congressional district in the country at the outbreak of COVID, when we didn't know anything about the disease. You know, we were still wiping down our packages because we didn't know about surface transmission or anything like that. But the thing is that, you know, it's, I'm not trying to make it seem like this big deal, but that is what leadership is supposed to be.
I have to say, I was really proud of you because I was like, this is what it looks like.
And I feel like I learned a lot of this too, from what happened with Maria, because when a disaster strikes, one of the most demoralizing and also where things can really start falling apart is when people start to perceive that leadership is not on the front line, you know, that they are putting themselves first in terms of comfort and safety when it's supposed to be the opposite, you know? And I think we deserve better. We deserve to expect more from our elected officials, especially on a federal level. I don't think that it's acceptable for us to watch other people make sacrifices without meeting them there and doing everything that we can. And it was a very difficult time because, you know, our federal government did fail in that response big time. And it was really frustrating for me that the thing that I felt that I could do best was get vans and get groceries so that families could be fed and source our own PPE at the time to fundraise and get it to hospitals. You know, that's shameful. That's shameful for any elected official to be in that position and that be the main way that they could help instead of actually providing the structural changes that we need.
So just so you know, the last in-person interview I did in March of 2020, Kat Von D.
Oh, there you go. Okay, flex.
flex in her house, like amazing. And then you are the first in-person interview.
I think this might be my first in-person press interview as well.
Oh my
God. It's been like all Zooms, I think. Yeah.
So how are you doing now?
Last year was overwhelming for everyone, but I do feel like it was especially overwhelming for our community. We were hardest hit. We had to discover all this stuff before the rest of the country had to discover it. And whether it was bagging groceries here or fighting with our own party last year as to why mixed status families and ITIN payers deserve stimulus checks, you know, it was exhausting. And you had that with the layer of just this fascistic Trump administration on top of it, with the intense stress and high stakes that the presidential election was. And then you have this transition period of escalating violence, which really culminated on the 6th, for which, you know, was an extraordinarily traumatizing event that's not really being discussed. It's politically sensitive. You know, no one wants to say, oh, boo-hoo. But there are members of Congress that served in war. And not just that, but also staff. You know, there's this woman whose smile I love, and she's just so incredible, and she's a food service worker, and her name's Veronica. And she works in the basement of the Capitol. They have coffee places, things like that. And all I could think of that day is how they, like, you have these people that are storming the Capitol, and there's no place for our food service workers to go, where our custodial staff went. The cycle has just been moved on, but it has deeply, deeply affected lawmaking, policymaking. It has impacted the actual legislative process, the aftermath of it. And it's very quiet. It's not spoken about. I think after the 6th, I took some time, and it was really Ayanna Pressley when I explained to her what had happened to me, like the day of, because I ran to her office. And she was like, you need to recognize trauma, and that this is something that you went through, but we're all going through. And it's really important to pause after that, because that's how you process it. And I feel like I learned this the hard way after my father had passed away when I was a teenager, because I was like, you know, firstborn, only daughter of a Latina family. You know how that dynamic is. Mm-hmm, and you need to like do everything. So that happened to me at a young age, and I socked it away. And I had to live with that for years. And so I learned my lesson then. And now I feel like I've had to take a beat. If I take a couple months now and just be really good, then I don't have to live with this thing festering and lingering with me like a roommate in my apartment for years.
So you're doing therapy?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm doing therapy, but also I've just slowed down. I think the Trump administration had a lot of us, especially Latino communities, in a very reactive mode. And so I've been putting myself in a more proactive space. And I've been...
What do you mean a more proactive space?
Like, you know, there is this thing where you have to like scroll Twitter all the time because the administration was announcing some horrifying change that it was like, how do we protect people now? How do we protect people now? How do we protect people now?
I mean, literally, it felt like every day it was...
It was like three cycles.
Right.
It was just an assault. And for a community that's 50% immigrant, that has really high concentration of essential workers, where we have mixed status families, you know, these federal policies that even Democrats champion don't help us. We're excluded from them due to just political convenience and narratives. And so, you know, moving to a place where while we have political differences with the Biden administration, at the very least, it's not this all-out constant assault. And now we can move to a place where we're making the argument on pushing on certain issues. You know, this crisis of what's happening at the border is a manifestation of just our political environment and attitudes towards immigrants for decades.
Centuries, too,
yeah.
So, I mean,
and then even longer, because there's a direct through line through imperialism and the attitudes and power structures there to anti-Asian violence, to what's happening at the border, to anti-Black racism, all of it. And there's a through line there, and our lack of acknowledgement of that. And it goes into our foreign policy and all of it. You know, people want to think that this stuff is disconnected because they want to believe in this mythology of America or the United States that we were fed as children.
I think, you know, 2020 was a culmination of confronting a lot of mythologies about this country, democracy, representation. Okay. But I want to just stay with this for a moment because having been through trauma myself, I can see that this is not a done deal, January 6th. This was an attempted coup.
Yes. And it's almost like we refuse to acknowledge it because we don't want to believe that it happened. And people think that it's some sort of exaggeration. This was an all-out attempted coup. Mike Pence was taken out of the Senate chamber something like 60 seconds before these terrorists and insurrectionists got into the Senate chamber. 60 seconds. And Mike Pence was the one person, arguably, that had one of the most important roles in making sure that procedurally the Electoral College counts went on as proceeded. 60 seconds could have meant potentially the difference between what we have right now and a martial state. And we don't want to acknowledge that that's how close we got, but that is how close we got. We think of coups as something that happens in quote unquote banana republics or in the developing or quote unquote third world. And it happened here. When I talked about how dangerous it was and there was this intense attack back on the right, it was a protection of mythology.
I think the question here is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez somebody who is credible or somebody who has a history of lying?
She even accused the cop who came in to assist of wanting to hurt her. She said he looked hostile and had a look in his eyes. So really, I mean, it is just crazy stuff.
People will believe this crap. Some already do.
And that's what a lot of, I think, the attacks on the right are about. There are certain mythologies that are really important to this idea of American exceptionalism. But there's also certain mythologies that are very important to maintaining white supremacy. White supremacy in and of itself is a mythology. And you have to protect it in order to protect that political power, which has now become a very important base in the Republican Party. And that's why that response was so vociferous, to make it seem that it wasn't as bad as it was. And it was bad. They constructed gallows, functional gallows with nooses, and they put it in front of the Capitol. And they were looking for us. And we were not protected. There are things that happened that day that if 60 seconds went differently, if a different door was opened, if a chair wasn't barricaded in a certain way, we could have a completely different reality right now.
Okay, we don't want to spend the whole time. because we could.
I think it's super
necessary.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the thing about this country that freaks us out the most is the capacity to just kind of, well, move on.
Yeah.
So you brought up the Biden administration, the virtual town hall that you held. You said that the Biden administration has been exceeding progressive expectations.
One thing that I will say is that I do think that the Biden administration and President Biden has definitely exceeded expectations that progressives had. You know, I'll be frank, I think a lot of us expected a much more conservative administration.
So help us to understand.
Yeah, well, so the second sentence after I said that was because we expected a much more conservative administration.
Correct.
It doesn't mean that he exceeded progressive standards, doesn't make him a progressive president. But I do think that, you know, if I'm going to be very frank, I think that their outreach and collaboration with House progressives, while I wasn't there at the time, from what I'm hearing from my colleagues, is less contentious than it was with even the Obama administration. And so when it comes to that perspective, I think the administration has acknowledged that there are very strong parts of the progressive movement that, frankly, like, save the party's ass in November. And they recognize it.
Oh, so you feel like they are recognizing
this. I think they know that. I think they know progressives delivered Philly, which helped deliver Pennsylvania, that it was immigration organizers in Arizona that helped save that state and that is helping turn the tide in the rest of the Southwest. And I think they recognize that politically because we sent a strong message that you ice out young people, you ice out people of color, you ice out progressive policies in a way that there's no give and is very condescending, we lose the House, we lose the Senate, we lose the presidency. I think they do recognize that. Now, that being said, we are still part of a larger party that has elements that are still clinging on to, I think, problematic neoliberal thinking, that the Biden administration has made appointments that aren't great in that vein. The president is the president. He has a very long history. I was expecting, you know, I guess it's
you had the lowest.
Yeah, exactly. I had very low expectations of this administration.
And so anything that is, you know, inching towards is like, okay, let's applaud that. But
yeah, for sure. I mean, it exceeded my expectations when they actually decided to have a conversation with us. So I think that's the thing, is that people made this whole like hullabaloo, but the asterisk is that my expectations were not high. And I think it's also part of a thing on race and gender, because we don't have the same high expectations of white men in politics that we do of people of color and women. I mean, that's just straight up. Like, for me, as a first-term freshman, I could not mess up once. I could not have a hair out of place. I could not say "and" instead of "but," and it was front page news. You know, for better or worse, Joe Biden can do that. He can have that day, and it doesn't even make page 16 of the New York Times. Like, we have to acknowledge that. It worked for Trump, and it also worked for Joe Biden, in that if you mess up, all is forgiven. And that is a structural advantage that men have in politics. They have the advantage of low expectations.
Seriously. So after Joe Biden's speech to Congress, I tweeted out something like, obviously, it's totally different than the Trump administration. True. Mm-hmm. But please don't be upset if I'm asking for more. It's not that I'm ungrateful, but specifically for me as an older Latina, I don't have a lot of time.
Exactly.
So on the issue of immigration in particular, I am honestly flabbergasted, I guess, because it's so easy in some ways to make a massive dramatic shift and change the entire narrative and secure support for the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is.
And yet you are hearing the same things coming out of the mouth of his spokesperson, which is, to refugees, can you just wait and come back later?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about where you're at on the issue of immigration and your patience level or not.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a patience level. The patience is gone. And I think that there's very slim window where it's like, okay, it's literally 30 days after the Trump administration, but now it's done. There are some things that are unacceptable. The reason I take issue with this term surge and all of these things at the border, and just even if, forget whatever you want to call it, the situation in general is unacceptable because people want to act brand new every time.
Like it's never happened before.
Biden administration, we couldn't anticipate this. The Trump administration, we couldn't anticipate this. The Obama administration, we couldn't anticipate.
It's like it's like Latinos and Latinas. And of course, not all immigrants and refugees are, but it's like we're invisible.
People act as though migration patterns haven't existed, period. And that they haven't existed in this way. And that this problem is brand new when it's just not. But the thing that I think is the toughest nut to crack is that this is about our foreign policy. And this is about both parties' engagement in foreign policy, particularly neoliberal foreign policy. A lot of the conversations I hear, even with my colleagues in Congress around the Northern Triangle and around all of these things, have to do with, oh, we need to send aid. And aid is important, sure, depending on the type of it, because sometimes it's very problematic aid that gets sent out. But what good is aid when we are helping to create the problem?
Coming up on Latino USA, New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez keeps our conversation personal, talking about her Latina identity and how she advocates for her community. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back. I've been having a conversation with New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and it's not lost on her that those of us still here, those of us who are still healthy and alive, that we've made it through a year with historic implications. Through it all, AOC has been reflecting on the need to learn about our own identities and personal histories. In her view, that's the first step in challenging the status quo and actually in creating a better future for all of us. It's not often that you get a chance, I guess, to talk a little bit about the issue of who we are. Yeah. And as I was thinking about you and this question, I was thinking about my students mm-hmm. now at Barnard, many of whom are still struggling with the essential question, am I Latina enough? Mm-hmm. Am I Latino yeah. enough? Where do I fit in?
Yeah.
And if we've been so targeted in the past, do I want to be Latina and mm-hmm. Latino?
I think a huge part of life is us just figuring out who we are and just continuing to grow into who we are. And there is this question of, you know, am I Latina enough? Am I Latino enough? Like, there's some ways where you can answer no, you know? In that we should know where we come from. And we grow up in a colonizing educational system that does not tell us who we are. And it tells white people who they are, right? You started this country. You are pioneers. You are explorers. And if you study world history, at least my experience in a public school system, world history is primarily just European history with a couple of, you know, side adventures in South Asia and Latin America. But the vast majority of world history, quote unquote, is European history. Right now, our educational system largely teaches white people who they are. And everyone else is a supporting character. And so if we really want to embrace who we are, it's kind of a tax in a way because it wasn't given to us. We have to give that to ourselves. I think there's kind of this laissez-faire, like, you're Latina, you're Latino, like that's enough. And in some ways it is, like you're born enough, mm-hmm. but also it's really important for us to know who we are because it will help us make a better world.
To do the work.
I think it makes us better parents. It makes us better neighbors to understand that. And I have this older neighbor, he's from Puerto Rico, and he sits on this bench all the time, every day. I'll walk past and it's just a little back and forth, but maybe he like drops a little story that I've actually learned a lot about Puerto Rican history and people's movements and the histories that aren't told through him, like resistance movements on the island. Those are stories that are not told, that are inconvenient to be told. And I think that that kind of work is important to us and for us. I think it's also part of this vague, weird political treatment of Latinos. It kind of balloons up into that, because if there isn't a concrete sense of identity, and it's not to lump us all in as Latinos, you know, we're Mexicanos, we're Boricuas, we're all of this, and we are also our collective identity, but we have to know who we are and where we come from in order to see what stuff that's happening today is like pretty messed up.
Okay, so I'm going to tell you this weird thing that happened to me recently. It was very surprising. Mm-hmm. It involves you. So I was on, you know, yet another Zoom in another city, mm-hmm. talking about the book or something, you know, and I've been quite frustrated, mm-hmm. because of the narrative around immigration, and this cannot continue to go on. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me a question, something about the future and when will things change? And I said, well, you know what? Things on the issue of Latinos, Latinas, immigration, it's going to change when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is elected president and she goes down to the border and she stands on the wall and she says, we are going to tear this down. Okay. And it freaked me out that I had such a specific image. And I'm a little bit like, why did that happen? Also, because I knew, you know, you're a politician. I have faith in politicians, but you know,
yeah,
critical.
Yeah.
But I was very surprised. And this is even hard for me to say, mm-hmm. because I was like, the way I'm feeling now is that it is going to have to be a Latina or Latino who makes that happen.
My visceral reaction to that is things will change when we change, because you can have a person march down and make an announcement, but none of that will ever be sustainable until we understand why that's important. And there's a lot of just reckoning we need to do with our country's history. And, you know, there's this idea of American exceptionalism, but I don't think we've really internalized how much of that has been created through the subjugation of other people. There's this one myth that it's all happened because we're smarter and perform better and ingenuity and all of those things. And all of that brilliance has a space in the story. But there's also turning a blind eye to union organizers in Latin America being murdered to protect American companies, to protect their bottom line, or Domino Sugar, mm-hmm. and the colonization of Hawaii. This quote-unquote exceptionalism is very deeply rooted in colonialism and imperialism. And so, you know, when we talk about this wall and this idea of a wall, it's like we want to keep all these riches in here, but people don't want to know where a lot of them came from. Even now, when we block people or set up all these impediments to people coming into the country, and then, oh, you can create a visa where people can come in under very specific employment conditions, sometimes just inhumane ones, because we like both cheap food, but we also don't want to pay a living wage. Something's got to give. And that's why I think it's important for us to know who we are, because what I fear too is that the more we get disconnected from who we are, our family histories, you know, where we come from, et cetera, it's very easy to just elect a Hispanic person or a Latino person. I don't even like using the word Hispanic, but in a way, it's like, it's a good word because politically, that's what gets elected, right? Hispanics. Like, that's the political landscape.
Hispanics.
Yeah, exactly. I would like a Hispanic. And it really is like very tokenizing, but also you can elect a Latino who doesn't know who they are, and they advance really problematic policies, and it happens all the time. In fact, it's one of the big reasons why I ran for office, because I come from the Bronx, and it's not like I grew up with the Bronx having all white elected officials. We had a lot of Latinos and Black and Brown elected officials, and they advanced the causes of corporate interests. That was almost even worse in some ways because it hid what was actually going on. That's why it's important for us to understand what's real, because any corporation can hire a Latino lobbyist and then have it seem woke.
So you're saying do the work.
Yeah, for us individually.
Right, for too. Us individually. Yeah. So because we all follow you, right? So we know about your gardening. I'm a succulentologist.
Oh, wonderful.
I only do succulents. We know about your dog.
Yeah.
The disconnecting, the I'm going, you know, I'm going to pull back. I'm going to slow down. I'm going to, what is that looking like for Alexandria in 2021?
Yeah. Well, I kind of, literally after the sixth, I don't know what came over me, but I decided that I wanted to go camping.
Oh, right. I've seen that too.
Yeah. I've never camped before. Like I was in Girl Scouts, but we went on like one camping trip once. My Girl Scout leaders were, you know,
a little urban.
More urban. And so one thing that I think the way I really internalized what happened on the sixth was like, I wanted a sense of not just control, but also self-reliance. Like just an idea that I could be dropped in the woods and be good. I don't know what it is, but
well, that's dude, just, if you can survive in the South Bronx,
yeah,
and you can survive being dropped in the woods.
It's weird, but that's just kind of, I think, where my mind went. And so I started with just really basic, like, not like Bear Grylls or anything out here, but I just started like car camping. Like, I got a little Coleman grill, you know, whatever. And it was really cold because I did it almost right after. I did it like in late January. Early February.
That's freezing.
Yeah, it was freezing. But, you know, I just felt like I needed to be away from all these people and all of this, like, you know, busyness. And so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go backpacking. I just started doing these like baby backpacking trips. You know, I'm not going out too crazy enough that I could hike out. But if anything goes wrong, I could hike back like 2-3 miles. And it's been so therapeutic and so healthy. And I feel like it's been one of the most helpful things for me in resetting than almost anything else that I've done. Hey, everyone. Hiking again this Sunday. I wanted to ask you, what if I told you that this is the Bronx? Pelham Bay Park. And I think that it just goes to show, too, going back to issues of inequity, is that these are things that are actually very difficult for our community structurally to be able to access. And green space, we know in so many different ways, from actual medical studies to public health and policy outcomes, that your proximity to land and that connection is really, really important for people's mental health and personal health. I think also in kind of talking about who we are, I felt this way when I went to Standing Rock too, connecting with indigeneity and the indigeneity of our identity and connection to nature is such an important element to that indigeneity. My great-grandfather in Puerto Rico was a medicine man and very connected in the mountains in Utuado. And so much of that history is oral. And so even though I'm out here in the sticks of New York.
You're like Utuado in my mind.
Yeah, exactly. But I do think that that connection to nature is really, to me, it really taps into a lot of the indigenous experience. And it's really hard, especially as a Boricua, because our people experience total genocide. And I'm almost like jealous of our primos and our primas that are Mexicano or, you know, our Peruvian fam and cousins, because there's more of a connectedness. And even though all of this was subject to violent colonization, there's much more documented history and understanding and identity and even language being preserved. And to be Puerto Rican is like, you know, you're something, but the history that we've been through has done a really strong number on connecting us to who we are. It's like how in the United States, there's a lot of tribes that are not recognized by the federal government. And so you don't get federal recognition, protection, acknowledgement. And it makes you wonder, is this just a story? And it's really important because it also cuts to a basic philosophy, a philosophical shift that I think we need to have in this time right now, because we are in a time that is challenging not just imperialism and colonialism, but challenging capitalism, which in many ways is also a colonial and imperialist economic structure.
That was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman who represents New York's 14th district. She spoke to me from her campaign office in the Bronx. This episode was produced by Alejandra Salazar and Miguel Macias and edited by Andrea Lopez Cruzado, with help and fact-checking from our intern, Oscar De León. The Latino USA team includes Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Ginny Montalvo, Reinaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Maria Esquinca. Our theme music was composed by Xenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org. Check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on social media. Y pues, ahí los veo. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities, where children come first. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Check her out, Ali. She's taking your job.
I'm a PA now. I need a credit.
Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, artist and singer Caliuchis tells the stories behind her genre-defying sound. That's next time on Latino USA. If I told you I was yours, you'd probably label me a boss.